Hey guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, news and interviews. Sorry, I've been kind of falling down on the job of getting good interviews lined up for you guys today. I still have an invite out to Patrick Coburn. Last I heard, he's running around southern Iraqi Shiistan, reporting on things. So I don't know if he'll be able to do it or not. But I do have Ray McGovern lined up to talk about the Iran deal and to talk about the new Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity memo on the subject of MH17. So that should be good. I'm more interested in the Iran deal. What do you guys say about the Iran deal thing? It's the spotlight. I made it the spotlight today on antiwar.com.
Is war with Iran finally off the table?
Wouldn't that be nice? And then also Michael Ratner. I've been trying to get Michael Ratner on the show all week because he is the, boy, I better Google it, but I think he's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Jeez, for all I know, he's written about this. I didn't even look it up. I better look it up right now. Anyway, I'm going to interview him about what Wesley Clark said. Let's see here, Michael Ratner. Let's see, I'm going to add to his name, I'm going to add Wesley Clark, just to see if in case he mentioned that here. And we're all lucky. Nope. Torture and murder. Nope, that's different too. All right. Well, anyway, so Ratner hadn't written about it, but I guarantee you he's got an opinion on it. And that's why I invited him on the show. Because as you've heard, regular listeners, as I hope you've heard, but you may not have if you just watch TV news, Wesley Clark... I mean, if you watched this on TV news, you saw it, but you didn't see any coverage of it after the fact. Wesley Clark called for radicalized individuals to be put in concentration camps for the duration of the war, which, as we know, will last for the rest of all of our lives. Anyway, hang on a second. So Michael Ratner's going to be on to talk about that. I don't know what all he's going to say about it. Like I say, he didn't write an article about it. I'm afraid that he might say that it would be legal, if not constitutional, that under current Supreme Court precedent, anyway, they can do it. Very interesting subject. NDAA, this, that, and the rest of it with Michael Ratner on the show today. All right. So, I got Max Blumenthal's book, The 51-Day War. I should have started reading it already. Well, I just got it yesterday. I was going to start reading it last night, and then I watched Bill Burr stand up. I love that guy, man. He's hilarious, isn't he? I watched that instead. Lazy old man Horton. I wanted to go skate vert, but couldn't. 51 Day War by Max Blumenthal. That's his book on Israel's assault on the children of Gaza a year ago. And I read an interview. I read an essay he wrote about it. And I read an interview that was for Tom Dispatch and an interview that Glenn Greenwald did with him for The Intercept. Both very eye-opening type of a things. I think y'all might be very interested in his work if you're not familiar. 51 Day War, so I'll be getting into that for you soon. All right, well, let's see what time we're here. All right, got a few minutes. Listen, I got a tweet this morning. I've been in a couple of different arguments like this. Now, this guy I don't think is necessarily a warmonger, but he took issue with the fact that I support, I don't know what it was that he was listening to, one of my interviews or one of the shows, where I was supporting the Iran deal, and he's saying, oh, it's at the expense of Congress's authority to ratify treaties. And I said, well, it's not a treaty. And then his argument is, yeah, well, but it should be. And so the fact that it's not is horrible. And I'm saying, yeah, no, I don't think so. And then we each invoked the co-authors of Who Killed the Constitution, Tom Woods and Kevin Gutzman, but then neither of them responded, at least so far. But anyway, the true libertarian position is that the U.S. government should not exist at all. So then it wouldn't need a nuclear agreement with Iran. Short of that, the Ron Paul position would be a piece of paper that says, I promise not to bomb you. Go about your business. I'd appreciate it if you'd remain within the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Thanks. Both of those include a lifting of sanctions. No treaty required. What's happening here is America is stopping doing things. Under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the unalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology. They have a safeguards agreement. America, and in fact the UN Security Council, has taken the position that that's not good enough. And we're going to put all these sanctions on you until you agree to additional protocols and subsidiary arrangements and make a deal where you scale back your nuclear program more than anybody else and expand inspections more than anybody else. And then at that point, we'll go ahead and begin to recognize your right to peaceful nuclear technology and lift all the sanctions against you for pursuing it. So why should that require a treaty? The treaty in question is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. America is now going to begin respecting the fact that Iran is a signatory to it, just like the United States is. In fact, under the treaty, America is obligated to help them with their nuclear technology, as long as it remains for peaceful purposes. Let's not worry about that. Okay? But for America to end the financial war against Iran, in exchange for them continuing to not pursue nuclear weapons, that clearly is an agreement that falls far short of a treaty. It does not require treaty-level ratification whatsoever. Again, take the Ron Paul example. If it was President Ron Paul, never mind Rand, if it was President Ron Paul, he would just say, I'm not enforcing any sanctions against Iran. And all threats to bomb Iran are hereby revoked, too. Here's your security guarantee. No treaty required. Promise not to bomb you. Just don't attack America, and you'll be all right. Simple as that. No treaty required. So anyway, I'm not a legal scholar on all the different levels and legalities of executive agreements. But America agreeing to scale back its aggression for the other side giving in to its demands, basically, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that needs a treaty to be legal. And look at all of Israel's sock puppets in the Republican Party who are doing everything they can to try to kill the deal. But they're not insisting on Senate ratification. In fact, when actually quite a few senators did sign a thing saying it was a treaty, and then that got the letter to the leaders of Iran that Tom Cotton supposedly wrote, that AIPAC probably wrote for him, and that Rand Paul signed. After they were shouted down by even Jack Goldsmith, George W. Bush's lawyer, the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, and mocked for calling it a treaty, they never brought it up again. And it's not that they're just quislings. They do want to kill this deal. They're quislings of Israel, not of Barack Obama and the Democrats. But they're not even trying that, because they don't have a leg to stand on, quite apparently. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the thing here, man. So they're doing hearings right now in front of the Congress. Really sucks that it's John Kerry is the proponent of the thing. Makes it difficult for people to swallow. Normal, decent, honest people say, Kerry's for something? I'm pretty sure it must be a bad idea. Well, no, this is the one thing he ever got right in his entire life. How about that? Also, he's great in The Edge of Darkness. Did you ever see that? Yeah, anyway. Here's something that's fun and comes up from time to time among the right-wing warmongers, particularly in Congress, who know nothing. They're always going on about an electromagnetic pulse. And this is propaganda that comes mostly from Frank Gaffney and the Center for Security Policy, which is sort of the lowest scum of the neoconservative movement. If you take, I know it sounds like kind of a redundancy, but I think you get my meaning. And anyway, they try to push this crap that one day, because magic and 1-2 skip a few, 99-100 and this kind of thing that you don't need to worry about, yada, 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 etc., Iran will have a nuclear missile that they will put on a boat and float across the Atlantic Ocean until they get over to the American Eastern Seaboard, and then they will launch the missile over the center part of the United States of America, say, I don't know, Iowa or something, Nebraska. And then they will detonate their nuke high in the air, and it will turn out all the lights in America forever, and then 90% of us will all starve to death. And no matter how completely ridiculous and stupid that sounds, they never revise their talking points. If you ever hear these idiots talk about the EMP, almost always you will hear them say, leading to the deaths of 90% of the American people. With one little old atom bomb, huh? Anyway, here's the thing about that. My friend Gordon Prather, he used to make H-bombs for a living for the U.S. government. I know, it's kind of a horrible thing, but became kind of a peacenik later in life, and so I'll take it. I like him. And he once told me, if an A-bomb is close enough to you to turn out your lights, electricity is the least of your problems. In other words, you just were turned to vapor. And so, yeah, and then the vapor turned to nothing. In a flash hotter than the sun. So you don't need to worry about your electricity. You're dead, dead, dead. A-bombs can't turn out the lights. Or not further than the actual blast range anyway. What turns out the lights are thermonuclear weapons. H-bombs. And that's a whole other animal than just an atom bomb. You know, as Daniel Ellsberg likes to say, the Nagasaki bomb that Truman used to kill the people of Nagasaki, that's the blasting cap. That's the percussion cap that's used to set off a hydrogen bomb. You have to make the situation, the area in question, hotter than the sun in order to make fusion possible. So you split plutonium atoms, and to make it in order to make it hot enough that you can then fuse hydrogen atoms together and take out a city the size of Houston with one shot. That's the super, the H-bomb. And in fact, it's not only the H-bomb, it's enhanced radiation H-bombs, a.k.a. neutron bombs, that can be used to, that could be used as a weapon to shut off the lights, but they have to have ICBMs, and they have to have enhanced radiation thermonuclear bombs, which the Iranians might get in a few hundred years or something, I guess. Yeah, 100 years. They won't, can't do that. It ain't a threat at all. It never was. It's just a hoax, a farce, a lie. America can turn out the lights. Russia, probably Britain or Israel, could make neutron bombs and turn out the lights in America. I think, I don't know if there's a single state on Earth right now that is verified to keep neutron bombs in its arsenal anymore. I think the U.S. did have some and then under one agreement or another got rid of them, at least supposedly. And by the way, even if some electronics were compromised by an EMP blast, that doesn't mean that no electronics could ever be repaired or replaced ever again, and that we all have to just lay down and die like a bunch of Somalis or Yemenis at the hands of Barack Obama and just starve to death. No reason to believe that at all. That's stupid. That's something Frank Gaffney said. And these Republican senators repeat. Oh yeah, Ron is gonna somehow, under expanded inspections, far beyond what it ever was before, now they're gonna make an A-bomb. One. And they're gonna float it all the way across the Atlantic without being noticed. And they're gonna shoot it, not to kill anyone, but just to turn out the lights in America. Because, you know, that's the 12th Imam says so or something. Frank Gaffney says so. Sorry for wasting so much of your time debunking such stupid crap. But anyway. Pentagon chief says Saudis are supportive of Iran deal. I don't know if that's really true or not. That's what they told him. And as well, they should be. Again, Iran's program is going from a safeguarded civilian electricity program to a double, extra, super, very, 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 very verified safeguarded civilian electricity program. So, why would the Saudis get more nervous about that other than if they're worried about America's changing relationship with Iran at their expense, which is a separate question, and which, according to the consensus around here, from Gareth Porter to the rest of them, doesn't look like it's going to change very much very soon anyway. Larison said the same thing. And now, by the way, and this is really important for the war hawks here, Netanyahu offers simple explanation of what Iran deal should be, and this is in the Washington Examiner. This is a right-wing paper that loves Netanyahu and agrees with him. This is not, you know, somebody like me mocking Netanyahu. That's coming up in just a moment. Oh, I guess I don't have time. Dismantle for dismantle is the ideal deal, Netanyahu says. Dismantle Iran's nuclear infrastructure for dismantling the sanctions. That was the original administration position. I think it was the right one. And then he says they get to keep their nuclear infrastructure. So in other words, what he's saying here is they have to give up their entire nuclear program, which he knows will never happen. Can never happen, is an absolute deal killer, non-starter. The only way that's possible is with an American invasion. So see, he's just a liar with a red herring. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. the future of freedom. FFF.org/subscribe. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, someone on Twitter just asked me about the EMP debunking, and my suggestion was to add the words Gordon Prather or Jeffrey Lewis from Arms Control Wonk is also, I think, pretty good on the EMP, has debunked that, I think, for foreignpolicy.com. Anyway, all right. Our first guest on the show today is Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hey, Michael, how are you? Welcome back.
I'm good, Scott. It's always good to be with you.
Good deal. All right. Now, I'm sorry to start your interview this way, but I think it's important we play this clip. It's a minute and a half here. Former general, Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, in fact, Wesley Clark on MSNBC.
Generally, you know, a lot of people would say you reap what you sow. So how do we fix self-radicalized lone wolves domestically?
Well, we've got to identify the people who are most likely to be radicalized. We've got to cut this off at the beginning. There are always a certain number of young people who are alienated. They don't get a job. They lost a girlfriend. Their family doesn't feel happy here. Mm-hmm. And we can watch the signs of that. And there are members of the community who will reach out to those people and bring them back in and encourage them to look at their blessings here. But I do think on a national policy level, we need to look at what self-radicalization means, because we are at war with this group of terrorists. They do have an ideology. In World War II, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that was freedom of speech. We put him in a camp. They were prisoners of war. So if these people are radicalized and they don't support the United States and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, fine, that's their right. It's our right and our obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. And I think we're going to have to increasingly get tough on this, not only in the United States, but our allied nations like Britain and Germany and France are going to have to look at their domestic law procedures.
General Wesley Clark.
All right. Okay. So, finally, that's over. All right. So, obviously, there's a lot to go over there. But I guess I will add before I turn it over to you, Michael, that he has since defended himself on Twitter, but actually only by doubling down, I think. He says, you know, I never said Muslims. So I guess that means, you know, right-wing and left-wing extremists of whatever color or religion in America are just as well up for grabs for him. That's supposed to be a defense. He never said internment. I guess he just meant concentration or maybe death or re-education or some other summer camp, maybe. And yeah, he said he never called for new camps. So I guess I'll just reopen Manzanar. I don't know exactly how that's supposed to be a defense, but that was his defense of what he said. So I guess I'll ask you whether he has any legal standing here for this kind of argument. Could they get away with that if the rest of the national security state found that they agreed with him on this?
You know, Scott, we should look at what he said precisely, as you started to do. And, you know, when you talked about how he tweeted this, I never said Muslims. Well, he did say that people were at war against and they have an ideology. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, who else did he mean? And so, but in some sense, you're right when by now saying it's not just Muslims, or I never said Muslims, you could say it's left and right. But, of course, when he meant it, what he said was the people were at war against. And you're right, he never used the word internment, but he said segregate people, et cetera. And then he said he never called for new camps. Well, you've made the point, and that means our existing camps, wherever they are sufficient. I want to say before we talk about him and the legality, it is an outrageous statement and completely ridiculous. It makes him into just a complete dummy. This is supposedly ran for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004, so he was supposedly a war hero in the Kosovo War. although there's lots to say negative about his role there. But he's building on a scaffolding that makes his statement not completely off the wall in this country right now. And the first place we've got to turn is to Obama. Obama, in a speech a couple of years ago, when he was talking about Guantanamo and closing it, he said, well, there's a separate category of people who we don't have enough evidence against or can't get enough evidence against, who we consider to be necessary to preventively detain or detain indefinitely without charges. So, yeah, sure, Obama's talking particularly about Muslims, in that case, people overseas in Guantanamo, but it's the same principle. We can put people into detention without actually having a trial. And so in that sense, Wesley Clark, you know, yeah, he's completely outrageous about this, but it's not like without precedent. And, of course, it's not without precedent from my period in the 70s when the United States and Hoover had all kinds of indexes, security indexes, administrative indexes, made up of all the people who were subversive, supposedly. That included Howard Zinn. It included James Baldwin. And it goes back even earlier, obviously, to the Japanese concentration camps in the war. So, yes, the statement is completely off the wall. But the big question I have, is this really what some people in this country who are in elites are thinking? And my guess is they are, because we're talking about these people believe that, you know, the Muslim so-called sleeper cells, whatever they call them, or lone terrorists, whatever they call them, this is a huge issue that our police departments look at all the time. They arrest people based on what their thinking is, what websites they visit. They arrest people, you know, for without having committed any crimes, and they set them up on with informants. And so not even informants, but people who are, you know, who are pushing them into, entrapping them into crime. So, yes, it's an outrageous statement, but let's just face it, in this country, as I said, there's a foundation for thinking like that. I think it will be rejected right now, but you have to say that Obama has not yet rejected it at Guantanamo. So that's serious, and it's hard to distinguish that from what Wesley Clark has said. Now, the question is it legal? Well, you know, obviously, in my view, Guantanamo is completely illegal. You can't set up some offshore detention camp and put people in there for now some 13 years, perhaps, or 14 years, and not actually ever charge them. And in some cases, some have actually, 50 of them have been cleared for release. So, yes, that's flatly illegal. Have we been able to get them out of there? Answer is most of them, no. A lot of those people remain in there. So yes, this is a call, I guess you would say, because this is a call for doing it domestically in the United States against U.S. citizens. You would have to say that I would hope that a U.S. court would absolutely never allow that. But, of course, we did have one case during the so-called war on terror of Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen, put into a detention in the United States. And finally, before that case got to the Supreme Court, my guess is even this Supreme Court would have held that illegal, the U.S. Indicted him and tried him and charged him with a crime and convicted him. So the answer is yes. Any decent constitutional lawyer would say the proposal is completely illegal. It's jailing people because of their thoughts. His exact words, as you said, was because they're radicalized. They don't support the U.S. Well, how many people do we know that includes? And they're disloyal. So is that a reason for jailing people? Obviously not. That's not a crime. You're allowed to think like that. And he even says that. He even says in that little clip you played, they have a right, they have their right to say this, but we have a right to segregate them for the duration of the conflict. Well, that conflict, is the so-called war on terror, is going to go on essentially for most of our lives. So it's an illegal statement. It's a stupid statement. The tweet makes it, I think, as you pointed out, perhaps makes it even worse. And as I said, it's built on a scaffolding of this kind of jailing of people without charges in this country.
All right, y'all. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Michael Ratner. He's from the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're talking about Wesley Clark and his proposal to start arresting radicalized, self-radicalized lone wolves and put them in detention camps. You know, maybe their family's unhappy and their girlfriend broke up with them and they need to be separated. We'll be right back after this break with much more. Michael Ratner after this. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism vs. Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism vs. Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm talking with Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights here. You know, make sure we get to keep some, a little, maybe. All right, so now a very important point you brought up there, Michael, is about the Padilla case. American citizen arrested on American soil at O'Hare Airport, turned over to Rumsfeld and Tenet to be tortured for a few years. And then, as you said, George Bush ducked, and right before it went to the Supreme Court, I think they ducked the issue themselves based on standing the first time. But when it came around the second time to the Supreme Court, he knew he was breaking the law, what he had done to Padilla. So he went ahead and turned him over to the Department of Justice and had him indicted and prosecuted. And yet, I don't think there was really any question that Padilla had provided material support to terrorism as far as that goes under federal law. He was easily convictable along those lines, although, of course, the dirty bomb and the apartment buildings bombing plot and all that was made up nonsense that they tortured out of poor Binyam Mohammed. But anyway, point being, they had some kind of charge on Padilla. But now the way, and maybe he left, maybe Wesley Clark left himself a little wiggle room here where he talked about, if you choose ISIS, then we got to lock you up. I mean, that's a very vague term. Nobody knows exactly what he meant by that. But it sounds like what he's saying is that just maybe if you like them on Facebook or whatever, then they ought to have the power to do to you what they did not have the power to do to Padilla. I mean, what they got away with doing to Padilla for a while, but did not have the legal authority to do to him.
They didn't have the legal authority to do it to Padilla from the beginning, but they never acknowledged that. And to this day, they haven't acknowledged that. What they did is rather than go to the Supreme Court and test the legal authority to put some in prison, a U.S. citizen in particular in this case, to put them in a U.S., not even a prison, a detention. He was in a military prison of some sort. They never acknowledged that they were wrong. All they did was not go to the Supreme Court and indict him on other charges and finally convict him, which is what they should have done to begin with, assuming they wanted to, assume they had evidence and were going to convict him. They shouldn't have just said, we can hold him forever. And the reason they wanted to say they could hold him forever without charges is not because they couldn't convict them, because they obviously could. It's because they wanted to establish the principle in this country that U.S. citizens who we don't like, who we believe are disloyal, who have connections with people we believe are disloyal, or in some way are, maybe in this case, are, you know, hanging out with the wrong people, that we believe we have the right to put those people in jail in preventive detention, in indefinite detention, for as long as we want. And that's, of course, exactly the principle of Guantanamo. The United States, in their view, I guess, the courts hadn't reached the point that they would necessarily approve that when they went to the Supreme Court. We don't know that. They made a bet that the Supreme Court, it's four conservatives plus would be Justice Kennedy, they made a bet that they might not approve that, and therefore they decided to indict him. But it's a scary, scary prospect, and for me the problem is I don't like distinguishing in any way, the people held in preventive detention in Guantanamo from American citizens who could technically perhaps be held here or maybe not.
They're all U.S. Persons, right?
Right. They're all human beings. And since when does the law stop when you're a U.S. citizen and you have to be indicted and tried to be kept in prison? And when you're not a U.S. citizen, you can simply be picked up by the scruff of your neck, tossed into a prison, never have a trial. And in this case, until we won the habeas corpus proceeding in 2004, Bush was going to deny them any right to go to court at all, period. So I don't separate human beings in that way, particularly when it comes to fundamental rights, to have a trial, to have your detention tested by a court. You just can't say that there's anyone who's exempt from that requirement.
Well, the Bill of Rights doesn't say that anyone is exempt from that requirement, does it?
That's correct. It does not. Certain of those rights have been held to apply no matter what.
All right. Now, so does it matter or not that it's not a declared war like World War II? Or would you agree with me that, legally speaking, it's a war on terror like it's a war on cancer? It's just a turn of phrase for PR. In real life, we have, some police actions and some kinetic operations and this, that, the other thing. But does that change? Does that really make the middle part of North America the battlefield in this thing?
You know, I've argued about this forever. I don't believe it's not a real war in the sense that Vietnam was, and, you have an enemy like that and all of that. And I argued for years that this is essentially a form of, police action, which they should have initially gone and tried to arrest the people they believe were involved with the perpetration of the 9/11 attacks. But they didn't take that route. They didn't take a law enforcement route. They just said, we're going to war, quote, war on terror, not a genuine war. Essentially, that's their position right now. Now, what I think is wrong with that is, so what if it's a war? Let's say it was a real war. Does that mean you have a right to put people in jail for their opinions about a war? You don't. I mean, the U.S. has tried to do that in the past. If it had been true about Vietnam, we would have had hundreds of thousands of young Americans go to prison because there's nothing but, and I was involved in it, hundreds of thousands of us on the streets saying, end this war, or saying, as you got to the more left part of those demonstrations, Ho Chi Minh, who is the leader of the Vietnamese, Ho Chi Minh should win. We had a chance like that. Does that mean that just because there was a so-called war, even if not a declared war, but that was really a war because there was a congressional, there was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and there was a tremendous amount of funding, et cetera. And
well, they have the AUMF of 2001 here. That's right. Not much different than the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
That's true. I would agree with that. That's against, though, the AUMF. There's two. There's an AUMF, and that has to do with Afghanistan, and then there's a separate resolution against Iraq. But that doesn't, neither of those, in my view, would allow the United States to engage in, never got authority, to bomb Libya, to bomb Yemen, to put troops into the Syrian war. None of those did that. So this is all, what they've done, both Barack Obama as well as Bush, they just expanded the meanings of those, both the AUMF and the Iraq War resolution. Now, the Iraq War, we pulled out, so technically over that war.
We're back. Got a couple of few thousand there now.
Right. In terms of the resolution, now it's the Iraq government that's asking us to come in.
Yeah, you're right, which is a different legal technicality.
Right,
there.
Likewise in Afghanistan. That war is over.
Right.
And in fact, our lawyers that I work with have made claims that you can't keep the people at Guantanamo anymore. To the extent you were relying on war authority, you can't do that. So we're really naked in this situation.
Well, now, what about the NDAA from, was it 2012, the NDAA of 2013, or it was 2011, it was passed, and it was regarding 2012, and it said, yeah, you can go ahead, and this is along the lines of what you're saying, all the outrage about when people, whether they're actual attackers like Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, or whether they're, entrapped by the FBI, you always have people like Lindsey Graham complaining that these people ought to be taken to Guantanamo as though, being prosecuted in federal court is, like nap time at the daycare center or something, no big deal at all. And they always have this faux outrage that terrorists are being treated under the rule of law when, of course, they should not. But so, and then the NDAA, a federal judge said no, but then was overruled by an appeals court. And that's where, and then the Supreme Court refused to hear it. So that's where it stands, that they do have that authority now again, just like back in the days of FDR, right?
Yeah, that is a huge issue, and that's the case. I remember that Chris Hedges went to court on and others to try and challenge that provision in the NDAA. But, the question of, Wesley Clark did try and put this into a war context, but he got his history totally wrong. He said, this is like the Second World War. He said, trying to analogize it to putting people in prison during the Second World War. Well, the one big thing we did in the Second World War by putting people in prison without charges was the Japanese. And that's which was hundreds of thousands of Japanese were picked up solely because of their nationality, considered disloyal, and put in concentration camps. And that's considered one of the great embarrassments and wrongs the United States ever perpetrated. And what he said, what Wesley Clark said, he didn't even mention the Japanese. He said, well, people who sympathized with Nazi Germany, they were treated as POWs, prisoners of war, and put in camps. That's just, there's no basis for that. That is not what happened at all. They did take a certain population because of its ethnicity and put them into a camp. They didn't say that people couldn't speak out and say, we support Germany. Hey, you can say that. You could have said that. Just like I said, I supported the Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. You can say that. It may not be nice. People may not like you for it. And they may want to throw rocks and eggs at you. But you can say it. And you don't go to jail for that kind of speech at all.
And now, there was a Supreme Court ruling on the Japanese internment that said it was legal, that upheld it. And that still stands to this day, right? That's never been challenged and overturned so far, has it?
Well, during the war, there was a ruling that essentially did what you said. It was a ruling on curfews. And it, in the body of that, it did do that. The Supreme Court then, as I recall, Korematsu, who was the main plaintiff during the war, Japanese man who was put in the camp, then went to the Supreme Court again. And as I recall, they never said it was illegal, but they did say that it appears that the evidence was falsified that put them into the camps. And then the U.S. Congress gave compensation to the Japanese. So the principle, what happened in the case was in the middle of the war, the military, I guess the DOJ came in and said, we have evidence that these hundreds of thousands of Japanese, particularly on the West Coast, you know, are plotting and blowing things up and doing all these things, and we can't figure out who they're going to be, and this is serious, and they're like a fifth column in the United States, and we have to jail everybody because we can't figure out the individuals. Well, that principle is obviously ridiculous, but you're right, that principle is not necessarily smashed to pieces. What was smashed to pieces was that the evidence for that population being, quote, disloyal or more than that, planning attacks, was fabricated by the United States government. So on that, if you want to call that a technicality, they said it wasn't a good ruling.
I see. All right. Well, I'm sorry we're over time here. There's a lot more to cover, but we'll talk
again.
Thank
you for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you coming on.
Important issue.
Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right, y'all. That's the great Michael Ratner. He's at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's fighting for your natural and constitutional rights. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. Oh, jeez. Sorry you had to hear that, Ray. Welcome back, everybody. I got Ray McGovern on the line. I don't choose the onion clips around here, dude. Now, Ray McGovern, he was a CIA analyst for 27 years. A Kremlinologist. And now he is the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. His website is raymcgovern.com. He also writes regularly for consortiumnews.com. And he gives anti-war speeches. Tell the Word is the name of the organization. You can find out all about it at raymcgovern.com if you want to have him out to give a speech. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Ray?
Thanks, guys. Doing well.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. You got a great article. Very happy to see this published in the Baltimore Sun. Is the military option on Iran off the table? So, is it?
Well, I'm happy to tell you, Scott, the answer to that is yes. It's really hard for many people in Washington and the rest of the country to reconcile themselves to that. But there's been a deal, okay? And it's not just a deal between the U.S. and Iran. It's a deal between the five Security Council members plus Germany with Iran. And it looks like the president has a Congress that, even though it will vote against it, it will not be able to overturn the veto, which he has promised to deliver. So, in my view, this is very, very good news. And the more so since this option, so-called, this military option, has been on the table now for over a decade. Now, people really need to realize what we're talking about here, okay? way back in 1648, at the Treaty of Versailles, okay, after the Europeans had killed off about a half of the population, they decided, you know, there's probably a better way to do this kind of thing, a better way to resolve disputes, and they concluded the Treaty of Versailles, which was supposed to prevent this from happening because there would be clearly defined boundaries against countries, and no sovereign country was entitled to attack another. Now, that was just the first. Then we had the Kellogg-Briand Treaty in 1928, which was supposed to do the same thing. Of course, it didn't. We got World War II, but after World War II, this happened in the tribunal, and they defined what the kind of war that was prohibited, a war of aggression, a war which is not undertaken because of an immediate threat against a country, but a war like Germany fought. And they defined a war of aggression as the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes, only in as much as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Accumulated evil, well, think kidnapping, torture, blackmail, the whole nine yards. And that's what inevitably happens when you wage a war of aggression. Okay, well, that's what happened in World War II. Then we had the UN Charter, which specifically prohibits people, any country, from undertaking a military action against another country without specific UN Security Council approval, except when the threat is immediate. There is no way that you can say there was an immediate threat from Iraq. And similarly, fast forward to today, there is no way that you can say that there's an immediate threat from Iran to the United States or even to Israel, which, let's remember, has 200 nuclear bombs ready to explode. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that this rhetorical advice, if Iran doesn't comply or if we find it cheating, all options are on the table, including the military option. Well, you know, that's really nice rhetoric, but it's against every manner of international agreement going back 3.5 decades, okay? Mm-hmm. But they still say it. But you know what? When the president got up before the press conference, what's today? Today's Thursday. What, it was a week ago. When it was Wednesday, right? So what did he say? Well, he said every manner of thing, but what he avoided saying was the military option is still on the table, or all options are on the table. There were several junctures. You know, I was leaning forward in my seat there watching the boob tube. And I said, oh, here it comes. It didn't come. He didn't say it. And so, you know, as a old criminologist, careful how you pronounce that, I look for things that are missing as well as things that are said. This was highly significant. It's going to go through. The military option is finally off the table because this time the U.S. is in favor of that. Now, people will say, well, wait a second now. There are all kinds of games that can be played by the International Atomic Energy Agency out there in Vienna. They've played them before. They've gotten this alleged computer, laptop, and all that from the Israelis, and that shows that the Iranians were cheating on this and that and the other thing. Well, yeah, that's worked for the Israelis up till now. But that's worked Kono, a Japanese diplomat, is in the U.S. pocket. So, and we know that from WikiLeaks traffic, okay? We know that from cables from Vienna, that when Amano was picked to replace Baradei, who was a really good director general of the IAEA, he thanked the U.S. profusely for putting him in power, and I need a little bit more money for the Drake delegate to fix up this office a little bit. So Amano is in our pocket. What does that mean? Well, this time, Amano's going to listen to us and not the Israelis, because we differ from the Israelis on this, and that's the big news here. We're going to see this thing through, and I guess I have to confess. Yeah. I have to confess to being surprised by this, because I had new doubts as to whether, well, that's how we say this, so whether Obama would have the guts to see this through. And I'm delighted that he has had the guts, and this may presage some more guts on other issues. I think that this is a new milestone in U.S.-Israeli relations in the first instance, because they are dead set against it. What, because they feel a threat from Iran? No, because they want the sanctions to continue and keep Iran in a subordinate position. So this is historic. It's properly described as historic. Secretary Kerry, the Department of State guy, he fulfilled the instructions of Obama, and this is all for the good. The Russians helped out. That's one thing that hasn't come through, but the president himself said, in effect, we could not really have done this without a lot of Russian help. So there are great possibilities here, and I don't usually sound like Pollyanna. I hope I don't sound like that now, but this is real. This is good. And I have to say, on this one, Obama made good.
Yep. Well, that's pretty much my feeling on it. Now, I want to go back a little bit to what you say about all the threats of aggression being against international law, that it's important to point out, as I think you mentioned, but I want to emphasize that this is the world law that's been foisted on the world by the United States, that the United States is the self-declared enforcer of, and yet we're going around acting completely immune from it, like a local murderer deputy sheriff in your neighborhood who can do what he wants in the name of enforcing the law and is never, you know, under the authority of it himself. But so I'm actually against the entire theory of collective security and the United Nations Security Council or anyone else being able to authorize aggressive wars. And I wonder, really just for argument's sake, whether there are any laws in America, the ratification of the Kellogg-Briand Pact or anything else that where it's the actual... Or something, no, something separate from that. Something that's just a domestic federal law that bans government officials making threats of aggressive war. Do you know if there's any like that? I mean, certainly it's immoral. We should all oppose it regardless. But I wonder if it's domestically a federal crime rather than just under international law, too.
Well, I guess, Scott, I would go back to the Constitution and the supremacy law, which 30... supremacy provision, which says that every treaty agreed to by the Senate is ipso facto
The UN Charter's not a treaty, though. It was ratified by both houses at bare majorities rather than by
the
Senate
at
two-thirds.
So it is a treaty. If you're asking me whether we blithely go around violating, well, Scott, I would remind you that we are the sole indispensable country in the world.
Oh, oh, that's right.
That? Yeah, you see?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're the sole indispensable country in the world, and you actually promulgate that, as Obama has done many, many times, well, then the Americans get the idea, well, you know, we can do what we want, whether there's a law against it or not. Mm-hmm. And I go back to 9/11 itself, and the account given by Richard Clark, who was in the bunker with the president, a few other aides, that evening after the president spoke to the nation. And when somebody said, well, now we can go after Iraq, somebody else said, well, you know, that would be, Iraq had nothing to do with what happened this morning. That would be against international law. Richard Clark quotes the president as saying, quote, I don't give a damn what the international lawyers say. We're going to kick some ass. Now, did anyone demur? Did anyone say, well, Mr. President, you know, there's such a thing as a war of aggression, and that's exactly what we would be committing. And, you know, our prosecutor there at Nuremberg said that the people sitting in judgment here are just as susceptible to having this law, this tribunal invoked against them as the folks who happen to lose this particular war, the Germans. So nobody said that. Everybody said, yes, sir, 9/11, fear, fear, let's get Iraq, even though they ended. So all I'm saying, Scott, is that there are laws on the books. There is the supremacy clause. But if you have the precedent of a president like George W. Bush and Vice President Cheney, and then his successor, a fellow by the name of Obama, who in some respects has gone even further in violating our law, witness the Fifth Amendment, right? Okay, no one shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, okay? That's still there. It's for the last time I checked. Well, how about Alaki? How about other American citizens that have been deprived of their life without any due process? What does the president say about that? Well, he has this cohort there, that fellow who just resigned from being Attorney General, Eric Holder. And he goes out to this fancy law school and he says, oh, if I read the Constitution, it says due process. It doesn't say judicial process. Well, you know, I mean, wow. It's always meant judicial process.
Yeah, Stephen Colbert said, no, it just means there's a process that you do.
Yeah, right. So all I'm saying is that you're quite right in pointing out that that we are bound by any manner of international and the national laws and the Constitution and the Supremacy Clause, but it takes a constitutional observer, as I think I'm a constitutional lawyer, to make that good and to have us behave as a law-abiding country and not as the sole remaining, indispensable country in the world. You know, I think I may have mentioned this before, but I have some fun when I talk to universities, colleges, and, you know, they don't do much English grammar anymore, but they usually know what a synonym is. So I say, you know what a synonym is? Oh, yeah, that's something that sounds, you know, sort of similar. So what's an antonym? Well, usually at least one, you know, knows what an antonym. That's the opposite. I say, okay, good. We are the sole indispensable country of the world. What's the opposite of indispensable? And, you know, scratched their heads, and one of them said, well, I guess it would be dispensable. I said, right. So by definition, all other countries are what? And they grudgingly say, oh, I guess dispensable. I said, well, yeah, right. So this kind of hubris.
You're insane psychopaths. Thank you for it's fun. It's fun when they're confronted with their dissonance, you know, in plain English for a moment, huh?
Yeah, well, when the kids kind of get onto it, they do sort of reassess the daily diet of propaganda that they get from the mainstream media, those who tune in. You know, one of the hopeful signs is that they don't read the newspapers, and they get a lot of stuff from Colbert and John, what's his name, Stewart, I guess, and they know the web. So if you tell them about this show, if you tell them about Amy Goodman, you give them a chance to, if they're responsible enough to want to know what the truth is, they can find it, and they can find it a lot easier than people my age who have trouble with computers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, certainly those things are changing very quickly. All right, now, so, and you know what, we're talking technicalities anyway. I was just wondering if there's any kind of federal law that really just makes that a crime for government officials to threaten aggressive war, you know, specifically in that way. But it doesn't matter. It's still obviously criminal anyway and has been all along the way that they, you know, aside from legalities. It should be intolerable to all Americans that, you know, virtually every politician in D.C. will jump at the chance to repeat that refrain that all options remain on the table, all seemingly including, in fact, even according to Obama's nuclear posture, right? All includes nuclear weapons. when he announced that America's former policy was we reserve the right of nuclear first strike against any country in the world at any time, and then he changed it to against nuclear countries or Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, happily, that may become academic as this thing works out. Now, it's going to take, I'm not saying it's going to be, you know, easy. It's going to take a lot of rhetoric and a lot of opposition and so forth. And it's going to take a lot of months before, for example, the sanctions are lifted. But unless there's a, well, what I worry about still is a false flag incident. We know, for example, from Cy Hirsch's reporting, that Cheney ordered the building of PT boats, or, you know, patrol boats, torpedo boats, that looked like, well, they were painted in Iranian colors. And there was a tentative plan to have one of those things shoot up a U.S. ship in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. Now, that's not made up. That was on the drawing board. They drew the line there. They said, we wouldn't do that. What's to prevent the Israelis from doing something like that now? Bear in mind, and this your listeners may not recall, but Obama came into office pledging to talk directly with Iran, right? Well, it took him, what, 8 months, on the first of 9 months, on the 1st of October, 2009, Bill Burns, one of his top diplomats, met with the top Iranians in Geneva. Now, what did Burns have under his coat? He had a proposal, which the U.S. and everyone else was convinced the Iranians had turned down cold, but because it involved taking the low-enriched uranium that they had in country, two-thirds to three-quarters of it, and shipping it abroad out of their control to be refined into a more refined state so that they can use it to power their nuclear medicine reactor, okay? So he gives this to the Iranian delegate, and the Iranian delegate on the 1st of October 2009 says, well, this looks good to me. We agree in principle. I'll go back and I'll sell this to the Ayatollahs, and let's meet in Vienna on the 21st of this month. Let's not waste a lot of time about this. 3 weeks from now, can you do it? And Bill Burns recovers and he says, well, really? Yeah, okay, we can do it. Well, what happens on the 19th of October? On the 19th of October, a terrorist group, and this is a real terrorist group named Jumbola, okay, traditionally funded by the Israelis and by the United States, has access to incredibly precise information about a meeting involving five Revolutionary Guard generals, okay, general officers together with their minions in a place in Iran. And guess what happened? Car bombs, big explosion, five Revolutionary Guard generals are blown up and killed 2 days before negotiations were to resume in Vienna. Well, who leads the Revolutionary Guard? The Supreme Leader does, okay, Khamenei. There's no, you know, you don't have to be a crackerjack analyst to know what happened next. The head of the Revolutionary Guard said, how the hell can you possibly trust these people? Look what happened. The U.S. advertised it, the notion that there's no daylight between Israel and the U.S. We don't know whether it was either or both, but how can you negotiate anything with these people? Now, they did go, they sent lower officials to Vienna, but they backtracked on some of the agreements. The next year, 2007, the Turks and the Brazilians were given express encouragement by the President of the United States, Barack Obama, to work out a deal with the Iranians resembling what Bill Burns had presented the year before. Guess what happened? They succeeded! This time, it was two-thirds or half of the low-enriched uranium. Now, you have to realize, if your audience needs to know, that the way you get high-enriched uranium, of course, is you start with low-enriched uranium, and if Iran is going to agree to ship two-thirds of it, or three-quarters of it, first one, or now half of it, that's a big deal, okay? Now, they agreed to do that. The Turks, the Brazilians, and Ahmadinejad were slapping each other on the back. They brought it back. Hillary Clinton put the kibosh on it. She said, we're not going to do that. We're going to do sanctions instead. Now, the Brazilian, De Silva, who was in politics, he wrote a letter to the president saying, well, wait a second, who's in charge here?
Here's the letter. I'm going to give it to the Brazilian press. You asked us to work out this deal, and now Hillary Clinton says, no, we're going to do sanctions? So there are two times in recent history, 2009 and 2010, when the saboteurs were able to undermine an agreement that was really promising, every bit as promising as the one we just had. So don't rule it out. But if something like this happens, we have a false flag sort of thing. You can expect people who don't want this agreement, who want to sabotage it, be crying from the rooftops that you just can't trust those Iranians.
Yeah.
They're not the way you heard it first.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, man, because it was not very long ago that there was a ridiculously fake attack that I racked up six of you former CIA officers to debunk it within the space of a couple of days, the so-called Iranian plot to kill the Saudi ambassador, that kind of thing. They could certainly arrange some farce like that, or like you're saying, a real attack by way of Jandallah or somebody else inside Iran, maybe, if it comes to something like that. Except, this is such a big deal compared to what was happening during, with the president so four square behind it compared to what was going on in October 09, where it still was like a little kind of trial balloony, kind of let's feel this out sort of a tempo to it or whatever. So where now it seems like if there's one reason for the Israelis to not do something like that, it's that everybody would know that they did. It would be so obvious. And half of American politics would have reason to want to believe that and argue it. You know what I mean? Or at least a major part of the Democratic Party and supporters of the president are going to be, you know, if it's, I mean, because how are they going to do something like that without it being obvious? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you make a good point there. Yeah, but
I mean, the Israeli government, they're crazy, so they might try it. I'm not saying they would definitely not try it or something, but it seems like they're going to get caught if they do.
Yeah. See, what I was trying to do is draw a distinction between what we might expect, and that is this kind of false flag attack, but what we can no longer fear expecting, and that is that the IAEA will be given some ostensible evidence by the Israelis. And the Israelis would come to us and say, hey, we're giving the IAEA this telemano to put the kibosh on this thing. Telemano to say, Amano is the head of the IAEA. Tell him to say that the Iranians are already cheating. We found something else, okay?
Yeah.
This time, that ain't going to work. Because Amano is in our pocket. He's going to do what Obama says, not what Netanyahu says. And, you know, I don't like anybody being in anybody else's pocket. But this time we'll accept it. And it's good news. The IAEA has a big role to play here. And so if they continue to take money, which they have, Amano himself, and direction from the U.S. this time, it's a good thing. These are ironical things, but, you know, life is full of ironies.
Yeah. Well, now, so obviously the president has made this his priority, but how do you break down the American establishment about this thing? And I know there are a lot of different power factions involved and different kinds of think tanks and whatever, but is it just the Likudnik right, you know, the Charles Krauthammers of the world who are opposed and everybody else supports it? Or is it, you know, more just left and right split, or how do you measure it?
Yeah, it's deeper than that, Scott. You know, I used to avoid saying things like the military industrial complex seems so hackneyed, you know. But, you know, you know, at 76 years old, I'm learning, okay? Now, it's axiomatic. Peace, a lack of tension, bad for business. Very bad for business, okay? War, tensions, good for business. Look what's happening with the arms industries now, with the increase in tensions over Ukraine. I'll give you a small sort of example. There's a arms manufacturing firm in Germany, Maffei, okay? They have a French counterpart. Now, their big project was the Common European Battle Tank, okay? And they were, they're get billions already invested in this thing, and they're going to sell it to everybody against they needed an enemy, all right? As soon as the Ukraine thing went up in tension, the stock rose. Mafai and his French counterpart, they're making all kinds of dough. And guess what? There's going to be a common European battle tank. And guess what? It's going to be so vulnerable to the latest high-tech weaponry that it's not going to be worth a darn, except for lining the pockets of the arms manufacturers. Works the same way in our country, of course.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a wonderful cycle, isn't it?
Well, you know, I talked with the journalist Mark Perry, and he was talking about some arms dealers in America who are lining up behind the deal because they want to sell weapons to Iran. That way they can sell weapons to America for the threat to threaten Iran with. But we can also sell weapons, I guess, parts for their F-14s and whatever else for them to defend themselves from America against. Or, yeah, bad language, but you understand what I mean.
Well, you know, that's just the name of the game. I was talking at a preview of a documentary on Iran, specifically about 1979, the hostage taking. And a little bit of history I introduced about the Shah. And the Shah, of course, when he joined that that cartel after 1973 and had such a profound influence on the price of oil, well, Kissinger gave explicit instructions. You sell the Shah everything you want, everything he asks for, except nuclear weapons. And, of course, there were two things there. Number one, to keep the Shah beholden to us to the degree we could, whereas he had all the leverage. But number two, a lot of people make a lot of dough on that. Now, a little footnote here, all right? Westinghouse and GE decided, hey, Henry, hey, Jerry Ford, you know, we think we ought to sell them a full-cycle nuclear development program as well. And you know what? They persuaded Jerry Ford, even though he had great hesitation. But we're talking about the same full-cycle nuclear development facility that we objected so strongly to for the last decade and more, okay? Now, Jerry Ford said, well, you know, I don't really think that's a good idea, but he signed on to it. As it happened, the Ayatollah came back in 79 and the whole thing became academic. But the pressure to sell people this stuff is incredible. And that explains largely why the Ukraine is such a fertile soil to plow for the arms manufacturers, why Iraq, why Syria is the same way. There are two things at play here. Look at what happened a year ago. Now, we had given the Iraqis $5 billion worth of weaponry and great training from my friend General Petraeus. Oh, they were crackerjack troops. What happened? The ISIL, or ISIS, or whatever you want to call it, fires a couple AK-47s in their direction. And what do? They run away. They didn't all run away. The officers in the Iraqi army took helicopters out of the area, okay? But they went away, okay? Now, what did they do? They left all the artillery, all the tanks, all the Humvees and everything behind them, okay? 2,000-plus Humvees. So what do? Well, you can't leave those things in ISIS hands, can you? So we destroyed them by air power, okay? And now what are we doing? We're selling $5 billion more stuff. I mean, is this a great country or what? What happens is a slice of those profits, of course, go to the people running for Congress. They appropriate the money to the arms manufacturers. They make a bundle of money, slice off a little bit of money to the congressional folks if they get reelected. I mean, is this a great country or what, Scott?
It's as simple as that. The economics of politics. That's what Obi-Wan Kenobi calls it. Perfect. And of course, it's the best game in town when it comes to investing money in buying a lobbyist to buy off a couple of congressmen. The bang that you get for that buck compared to any other investment in America, especially when it comes to Pentagon spending, there's just really no comparison. So for any businessman who just has a bottom line and no morals about it, it's all about that government contract. And if you're big enough to afford the lobbyists to get you more government contracts, you'll never have a real job again in your life, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, why don't you and I set up a contracting firm here and see how much money we can make? You know, I think we're in the wrong business.
I guess so. The thing is, you gotta stop truthing us out of war and start lying us into it, and then the checks will start flowing. Now, hey, wiggle your phone or stick your head out the window or something, because your audio just got even worse on us again. There, we've been making do pretty well, but
okay, I'll open the window here. I'm on a part of the beltway here that's not very good.
But, all right, so give me some comments on these subjects here. It turns out the Israeli politicians are all, of course, coming out against it. But according to the Jewish Daily Forward this morning, and actually Jim Loeb's blog had a piece about this, all of the retired security professionals, the former heads of Shin Bet and the former heads of Mossad, are all coming out, or I don't know all, but many of them, a dozen or so, I think, or 10 or 12 or so, have come out in favor of the deal. And I wonder if you could comment on that, as well as if you could comment on the Israel lobby's efforts in Washington, D.C. to scotch the thing. I mean, as you said, it doesn't look like they have the votes to override the veto. The Democrats are going to stick with the president on this, and what are they going to do about it? But so that's the question. What are they going to do about it?
Well, they're going to scream bloody murder now, and they're going to make this deal out to be a support for terrorism. Now, this is what they say. When you release those billions of dollars that are properly belongs, they are certainly not going to invest in economic development. Now, what they're going to do is give them to terrorists. That sounds familiar. You don't give WMP to terrorists, but you give them a lot of money. Well, that's a lot of hoopla. That's what we're here. The region that Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government, mind you, okay? The reason it's such a potent political force is not because of its little terrorist wing. It's because it set up medical facilities, health facilities, other educational facilities in Lebanon, the kind that Hamas has done in Gaza. That's what contributed to the electoral victories of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. We didn't expect Hamas to beat the Fatah, the old corrupt people that were under Yasser Arafat, but they beat him handily. If we had known that the election would be free and that Hamas would win, we never would have sponsored it. After the election, we tried to remove these guys by a coup. It didn't work. That's why Israel has put a boycott on goods to be delivered to Hamas. That's why they have this quarantine where you can't even get the freedom flotillas of the kind I was on 4 years ago into Gaza. It's to show a lesson to these folks that, you can't really do this kind of thing, even if it's a freely elected government. So, people need to know why these people are popular. And it's not because they shoot unguided rockets at the southern Israel. It's because they did things for the Palestinians and for those people in southern Lebanon that the old Fatah people, the Yasser Arafat people, corrupt as they were, did not do. So these things need to be faced. They need to be called by name. A little truth needs to be spread around, and people need to be told that, for example, with respect to Gaza, every few years Israel does what it calls mowing the grass in Gaza. Last time, 2,200 mostly civilian Palestinians killed, okay? And they do that kind of thing because they have the support of the United States. Now, support of the United States? Well, we give them $3 billion a year, let's face it. And now they're asking for more as sort of a compensation for living with the Iran deal. So people need to know that. And most important, of course, is people need to know that terrorists, so-called, or Palestinians, people don't come out of the womb, Islamists. They don't come out of the womb screaming, "I hate America! I hate America!" They don't hate us because of our freedom of our poor democracy. They hate us because our very close identification, not only with dictators such as those in Saudi Arabia, but with Israel. When we say there's no daylight between Israel and the United States with respect to policy, that is the kiss of death. because that gives people no hope that the United States will withdraw its support to Israel. And when you have no hope, you do terrible things, and that's called terrorism.
All right, now, so what about the Israel lobby and AIPAC creating this new group to oppose it and all their efforts in D.C.? Is it, you think that's going to be counterproductive for the lobby in the long term as just really sticking out as, yeah, it's the agents of a foreign power who are most against this when we live in a country of 300 million?
Yeah. Well, Scott, I think that may be gilding the lily a little bit. You know, with the predominant lobby influence in the what we call the mainstream media, the media have the ability to deprive most of our fellow citizens of the real scoop on these things. So even if Netanyahu and his crowd lose this one, and it's a big one for them, they can, you know, can rest in the assurance that the whole thing was bogus to begin with. A friend of mine said, you know, Ray, you ought to just write an article that says, victory, Iran has agreed not to work on the nuclear weapon that they haven't been working on since at least 2003. Most people don't know. Nobody refers to the National Intelligence Estimate. Okay, that's the highest genre of intelligence analysis produced in 2007, which said unanimously, with high confidence, all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies signing on, quote, Iran has stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. That judgment was reaffirmed every year since. So what do you really have? You have people disappointed that now it's written in black and white that not only are they not doing it, but they're prohibited from doing it. Okay? Now, I included in that Baltimore Sun thing something that your listeners might be interested in, and that is that when that estimate came out, it was really startling. What had happened, long story short, was they got an honest manager of intelligence named Tom Finger in from the State Department and asked him to do an honest estimate on Iran, given the debacle that had happened a couple of years before in Iraq, and he did so. He was favored with a little extra evidence that came in during 2007. But in November of 2007, he issued this National Intelligence Estimate, having kept it pretty secret from everybody, apparently, because the Bush. Now, I don't suggest that your listeners go out and buy his memoir. It's called Decision Points. If you have to, you can go to the library and look at it. But I want to quote from it, okay? This is what he says. I get the page. I wrote the page when I initially read the book. You have to read these books if you're an analyst. If you're an analyst, okay. This is what he said. The NIE, quote, tied my hands on the military side. After the NIE, how could I possibly explain using the military to destroy the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program, end quote. Well, bummer. Now, if Bush and Cheney were really, if the Israelis were really afraid that Iran was developing a nuclear weapon, what would have been the expected reaction of an NIE that says, no, they stopped doing that 4 years earlier? Well, you know, hey, wow, are you sure? Hey, do you double check? Call the Israelis. What wonderful news. Iran's not working on a nuclear weapon. No, no. That's what Bush does. Bush says, bummer. This is, he called it eye popping. And it deprived him of the military option. There you go again. The military option was on the table, regardless of international commitments. And this deprived him of that. So, you know, this has a long history. And, you know, I am so delighted to be able to tell you, and I'm surprised to be able to tell you, that in my book, this really is a historic agreement, even though what it does in essence is to say, now, Iran, which has not been working on a nuclear weapon since at least 2003, is obliged by law not to work on a nuclear weapon. The other thing, of course, is that there's a fatwa. Now, some of us Catholics, you know, we know about papal encyclicals, and, you know, we take them or leave them, maybe. Okay, but fatwas? Those are Muslim edicts, which are taken very, very seriously. Why do I mention that? It's because the Iranian Ayatollahs have a fatwa against developing weapons of mass destruction. Now, most Americans say, oh, right, well, that's great. You know, that's like an encyclical. You listen to it or not. Not so, folks. During the war between Iraq and Iran, 1981 to 1989, the precursor chemicals that we had made available to Iraq had been worked into nuclear weapons. They were using them, as most people know, against the Iranians. The Iranians had these mass assaults, and they were decimated by chemical weapons. Now, the Iranians also had the capability. They didn't develop them. They didn't use them, despite the provocation. Well, you know, that says something to me. People can dismiss promulgations and encyclicals and fatwas. This one is not so readily dismissed. They take this seriously, and so should we.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that. And it is, as you say, it's the kind of thing where, yeah, politicians say lots of things. And you know what? Holy men say lots of things, too. But, of course, yeah, no, in context, he was forbidding his government from retaliating against Ronald Reagan-backed U.S., Iraqi attacks against them. In fact, you must have been briefing the vice president about how successful Saddam's chemical weapons attacks were at the time, right? Fill us in, man.
Well, I was briefing Secretary Weinberger, who on that great big table that he has in his office used to keep track of what was going on, like a World War One general or minister of defense. And, there was great interest in all this. And the sad thing, of course, is they knew exactly what was going on and did nothing to prevent it. I mean, this is serious. I mean, you don't have to go back to World War One to realize the horror of using these kind of weapons again. And yet, the Iraqis did. We knew they were doing it. And we didn't even say boo. Why? Oh, they were fighting the Iranians. We didn't like the Iranians even more. And we ended up just like that kind of thing.
Well, you know, Matthew Aid's work at Foreign Policy says that you guys were helping them with the targeting and everything, not just turning a blind eye, but here's the satellite information that you need.
You can ask the Defense Intelligence Agency about that. My information is that's absolutely correct. And it's a third chapter that it's there. So, you know, you choose your bedfellows, you choose your enemies. It all has to do with who's in power, Reagan then, Obama now. The distinction now seems to be that Obama has refound some guts. You know, what I said one time in an interview, you know, we had such expectations and hopes. Hopes and change, right, for Obama. Well, Colonel Mo Morris, who was the chief prosecutor in Guantanamo at the time, Air Force colonel, okay? And he had great hopes for Obama, too. And somebody asked him when he was ordered to continue or prosecuting people in Guantanamo and disregard the torture, people said, well, how do you account for your expectations for Obama? And what he's doing here, he's not closing Guantanamo. He's bowing to the CIA and everybody else, the DOD. And Colonel Morris says is, well, you know, I hate to, the best analogy I can think is that on Inauguration Day, somewhere between the Capitol and the White House, Obama's testicles must have fallen off on the road. And that's the way it's been until now. And, you know, I'm allowing myself to have just a modicum of hope now that this guy will rise to the occasion on other things besides this historic deal on Iran.
Yeah, yeah. Well, don't get too far ahead of yourself here, Ray. You know, no, I agree with you. You know, Gordon Prather said back when Obama first took office, he wrote an article called Obama the Great. And it said all he has to do is just give a speech where he says, I promise as long as I'm president, we will never bomb any IAEA safeguarded facilities. And then that'd be the end of that. And that would take the entire war against Iran off the table as long as they stay within their agreement. As you said, they were already not making nukes. They were already still within their agreement. And anyway,
yeah, well,
so he finally got around to being Obama the Great on this issue, but he's absolutely horrible on every other thing. And you can ask all the rotting corpses in Yemen and Libya about that, except they can't answer you because they're dead because he killed them. But I think it's a guaranteed fact that Jeb's going to be worse. And, you know, the Republicans could walk right in here. They're all swearing to God right now. They're going to undo this deal the first chance they get. And I don't doubt it.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. I remain skeptically hopeful that this deal, number one, will go through, and number two, that whoever succeeds Obama will not be able to derail it, because, as I said at the outset here, it's not just Iran, Israel, and the United States now. It's France, it's Germany, it's Russia, it's China, it's Britain,
right?
And this deal is deliberately constructed that way. And I have to give credit where it's due. Obama and John Kerry made it work.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, we've seen how the Republicans in the junior years deliberately forced, you know, kind of bullied North Korea until they finally quit the treaty and kicked the inspectors out and decided to start making nukes, and they kept trying to do that to Iran, and it wouldn't work. We even remember now, I've forgotten for a few years now, but Ray, I just remember there's that great clip of John Bolton explaining that's what we're trying to do, is get them to go ahead and quit the treaty. If we won't abide by our end of it, maybe they'll just throw their hands up and then that would provide us with a better excuse to bomb them. But the Iranians never fell for that trick. They kept their hands up the other way, hands up surrender the whole time, their books wide open, and their safeguards agreement in effect, and said don't shoot, and now it finally, you know, paid off for them 6 years into the next administration. So it seems like, you know, I guess Jeb could step it up, but they already know better than to fall for that scam. You know, they obviously prefer to remain within the NPT and try to deprive us of that excuse to bomb them.
Yeah, and again, the IAEA has a central role here. The White House has inordinate influence with them, which it does. And if the White House is no longer going to support and spout the Israeli line on this, that's good news, and it's an important factor to consider.
All right, Ray. Well, I've kept you way over time here. Thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's great to talk to you, as always.
Hey, most welcome.
All right, y'all. That's the great Ray McGovern. He's from Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he's got the spotlight today on antiwar.com. It's this piece in the Baltimore Sun about Iran. And then he's also got one at the antiwar blog and consortiumnews.com, which is not just him. It's the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, quite a few other former CIA officers, et cetera, who have signed on to this memo to the president saying that they ought to release all the information about the shoot down of MH17. So you'll definitely want to take a look at that. Sorry I didn't get a chance to ask him about that, even in an hour-long interview. But anyway. All right, now, so in the last couple of minutes, I actually had another couple of things to point out to you here. First of all, I want to make sure you saw this, or I don't know, whatever. You don't have to look at it if you don't want to. But there was this thing where Angela Merkel, the president of Germany, was meeting with this group of kids, and this little Palestinian refugee girl started crying. Because she says, you know, hey, I've been going to school here and I want to go to the university like all my friends, but me and my family, we're being deported. And Chancellor Merkel kind of made an ass of herself, saying, oh, there, well, you know, if we let you stay, then we'd have to let all these Africans come too, and then we just can't have that. Now, white supremacy is long dead in Germany, you understand. And anyway, but the point of it is, to me, is the question, there's obviously a lot of questions here, but most important, How come she's got to live in a refugee camp in Lebanon when she goes back, quote, home? How come she can't go back to her home in Israel? Same reason she can't stay in Germany. Wrong skin tone, wrong religion. That's why she has to go back to a refugee camp. And why is that? That Israel gets away with that? Because Germany helps them get away with it. Just like the United States helps them get away with it. Just like the rest of the European Union and all the allies help them get away with it. And so, yeah, forget her, right? Who cares about her? She's just, I don't know, 1/10 of a human or something, right? She doesn't count, so forget it. Oh, man, I ran out of time to complain about other things. But I'll be back tomorrow. I'll have Patrick Coburn on the show for you tomorrow, too. Thanks for listening, you guys. See ya. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.